This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. And we're talking this segment about the film Very Semi-Serious, a partially thorough portrait of New Yorker cartoonists, which opens at the CCA here in Santa Fe this Friday. Emily Flake joins us by phone. She's a longtime New Yorker cartoonist. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So I watched this film last night. I laughed out loud during the entire thing. It's just brilliant. It includes a lot of cartoons. And a lot of the cartoonists are in it, including you. Tell us a little bit about the path by which you became a regular cartoonist for The New Yorker.
Sure. I started submitting in 2007. I had an alt-weekly cartoon that I do on a weekly basis. And I became friendly with one of The New Yorker cartoonists, and he said, well, you know, if you ever want to submit, let me know, and you know, I'll go in sort of as your Sherpa, so you don't feel kind of as a wingman. So I went in with him and started submitting, and just started submitting every week, and then I sold my first cartoon in 2008, I believe.
And that whole process of submitting is shown in the film, and here are these people who were submitting probably a total of about 1,000 cartoons a week, so that 15 can be selected.
Right.
And it's such it's just such a setup for hard work and rejection.
It is. It's a masochist road for sure.
Yeah. And at the same time, it's also hard for the cartoon editor who has to select among a lot of, I thought some of those ones that didn't get into the magazine were absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, no, it's an embarrassment of riches he has to sort through, that's for sure.
Yeah, and then what happens? That never gets seen. I mean, I was envisioning a website devoted entirely to rejected New Yorker cartoons.
Well, there's been a few collections of rejected cartoons. Also, you're free to sell them somewhere else if they don't sell to the New Yorker, but the New Yorker is kind of the only game in town for gag cartoons. Actually, Mad Magazine still buys gags, and there are a couple of few places, but it's not nearly there's not exactly a wealth of places to choose from. So sometimes if a cartoon is particularly good, it'll go back in the mix for another, shot at the magazine. But sometimes there's just there's a big graveyard of lots of really good ideas.
When you say Mad Magazine buys gags, are they buying the ideas or the cartoon itself? What do you mean?
Mad Magazine often buys single panel cartoons and sometimes I have sold jokes to them that they've had somebody else draw if they thought that a different artist's style suited them better. And sometimes they buy the jokes and I draw it as well.
It's interesting because, I think in the world of, at least the little I know about it, of comic books, there's a whole world and graphic novels of people who you've got the writer and you've got the artist. But in cartooning,
right,
pretty much you've got to be both. Is
that
right?
That's true. Yeah. And I think sort of across comics genres, there's a lot of people who do both. There's some division of labor in some formats, but I think being able to draw and write are two skills that, it's not really just gag cartoons. A lot of graphic novelists and graphic journalists do both. So, you gotta wear a couple hats.
Yeah. Now, how did you start when you were young? Did you always have the artistic ability and the sense of humor kind of both going full guns?
Yeah, I always drew and I always I always wanted to be funny. I had a lot of failed attempts throughout grade school. But I always wanted to draw. I always knew I wanted to be an artist in one capacity or another, for sure.
So here you are doing this, and one of the things that I thought was both striking and familiar was when you said in the film that having an unhappy childhood is almost like a prerequisite for cartooning. I've heard other people say that about comedy too, and a lot of discussion came out about that when Robin Williams took his own life. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it's just a matter of having your perspective take sort of a forced shift. I feel like comedy especially kind of comes from a place of questioning the world as it is. And I feel like if you're happy with the world the way it is, you are less likely to question it. You know, I think that comedy is born of asking a lot of questions and seeing things in a new way. And again, I feel like contentment is, especially when you're growing up, I feel like contentment doesn't really lead you to a place where you're questioning in that way.
Right, exactly. And at the same time, most people who are unhappy don't have that outlet. There must be something. I mean, there were people in the film who were saying, you know, this is the way that I kind of deal with my life and deal with society.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think framing it as a defense mechanism also, you know, is also totally valid. And, you know, in the same way that not everybody who drinks too much is Charles Bukowski, not everybody who has it rough or has any kind of, you know, depression has a knack for writing jokes, you know? I mean,
right.
it's I think it's one of those kind of sort of a perfect storm that has to happen in the person, I guess.
Right. You can call it a gift. It's a gift.
Exactly. It's a gift.
It's also, when you just said defense mechanism, I suddenly flashed back to many uncomfortable dinner conversations where the people at the dinner table had radically different political views. And my own experience of that is pretty much the only way to get through that is to leave as soon as possible or start telling jokes.
Yeah. deflect. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. That's definitely a part of my life at the moment. I'm working on my dinner table game for the next time I go visit my parents.
Oh, dear. Moving right along, we're talking to Emily Flake about the New Yorker cartoon. It's the documentary about New Yorker cartoons called Very Semi-Serious. And there's such a New York sensibility. I mean, here we are. We're talking to you from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And that New York sensibility to the cartoons, it's really interesting. And it's, you could see it as they're making fun of New Yorkers or making fun of the readers of the New Yorker. But
right.
I don't really see it that way as much as it's like they're laughing at themselves. I mean, it seems like the cartoons are kind of like we are poking fun at ourselves because we know we're all this way.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that I feel like because most New Yorker cartoonists are New Yorkers, I think maybe the poking fun at themselves is you're able to sort of poke fun at the sort of readership and the New Yorker vibe and yourself kind of all at the same time a little bit. I mean, I think that turning your humor back on yourself is a pretty time-honored way of both writing jokes and kind of a framing device through which to like you see the world really. So I think it kind of does both. I think it's, you know, and I think that also the self-deprecating humor, I think when it finds like a universality, is kind of like saying, like, aren't we all like this?
Yeah.
That was kind of a that was a very disorganized answer to that question. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, it's like, because so much of your readership is way outside of New York. It's not just
right.
It's not just like a local weekly or something like that. Everybody's reading it, and we get, I find that I get 95% of the cartoons, but not all of them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the only ways in which it would be like obtuse to somebody who didn't live in New York is if there was like a specific like subway joke or jokes about the, you know, there was one where Godzilla's stomping down the West Side Highway and a guy in a cab is like, fine, just take the FDR. And that's, you know, that's a very New York specific cartoon.
Right.
But I think in general, the readership of the New Yorker is, you know, like you just said, is not necessarily centered in New York, but I feel like they're probably all oriented towards the same general media intellectual diet, if that makes sense.
Right, right. Now, do New Yorker cartoonists form a community of some kind? Do you hang out with each other, and do cartoonists in general have like a their own subculture where they know each other and everything?
Yeah. For years and years and years, there was a tradition of going out to lunch after the meeting with Bob. Since the offices have moved, I feel like that's sort of fallen by the wayside somewhat. But you know, we're all pretty friendly with each other, which is really nice. It's actually a lovely community of people to be in. You know, it's much more supportive than you would think given the level of competition.
Well, is it possible to make a living at this point in history being a cartoonist?
Well, I think that with any freelancing, I think you need to have sort of like a variety of, like a lot of different income streams, you know? So if personally, like, I always feel a little nervous when, you know, like I've got one main client, say, and everything else is drying up. So I think you have to keep your fingers in a lot of different pots. I mean, that said, the New Yorker is by far my biggest client. I'm very lucky to have them. But I don't think it's advisable to only, you know, like to try to make a living off of one particular client. And if you're a cartoonist, then you have skill sets, you know, in terms of writing and in terms of drawing that sort of allow you to, you know, explore writing and illustration as options as well. So, you know, I am also an illustrator and I write. I had a book come out in October. I teach. You know, there's a lot of different hustles.
The film references the golden age of cartooning, in which there were just dozens of magazines that bought mm-hmm. cartoons every week. And one of the older cartoonists said, you know, you might submit a bunch of work and 95% of it would get rejected, but there were 95 magazines. So,
right.
those were the good old days.
Yeah, more magazines would be better, but, you know, poop in one hand and wish in the other one and see which fills up faster, but that's probably not the most radio-friendly way to describe that sentiment.
Do you have a small child, don't you?
I do.
Which is the fodder for some of your humor.
Definitely. I mean, I monetize her and the experience of motherhood as much as I possibly can. So, she's funny. And being a parent is funny. The book that I had come out in October is called Mama Tried, and it's cartoons and essays about parenthood. So I mind my own life and thus hers pretty relentlessly.
Right, right. Now, what is the process like for you of coming up with new material? Is it just sort of there all the time to be plucked out of the air? Is it hard to find the ideas for new stuff each week?
I mean, it can be a slog, and sometimes you hit a vein and ideas reveal themselves to you quickly. It really, basically, you kind of have to walk around with your antennas up all the time. But there are exercises that you can do to sort of help strengthen those antennas. And those exercises won't even necessarily in and of themselves produce a good idea. It just sort of primes your brain to accept ideas that are floating around out there.
What kind of exercises? What do you mean?
You know, sitting down and playing like word games with yourself, doodling, word association, making sort of mind maps. I like to like mash a bunch of different like ideas together and kind of see if there's anything to kind of spark this like friction between the expected and the unexpected. And again, it's not even necessarily that in and of itself you're like, oh, that's an amazing idea. But it paves the way. It's kind of like those activities are the lure that you lower down into the ocean and hope that it attracts some, you know, some ideas, some fishes.
Right, right. Every week, my mother subscribes to the New Yorker, and I go to her house every day. And when the magazine comes, immediately look inside the back cover at the cartoon contest. So there's a captioning contest mm-hmm. where a picture is given with no caption, and the readers are asked to submit captions, and then there's mm-hmm. one with the three finalists, and then there's another one with the winner. So there's always three cartoons. And every mm-hmm. single week, I look at it and draw a complete blank, and then
right.
I look at what the others have written, and they're absolutely brilliant and hilarious. And
right.
Well, first of all, do you draw some of the cartoons without the captions for that?
I've had work that I've submitted be used for the caption contest. They pull from the submissions, and basically if they like a cartoon but think that they'd rather put it on the table for the public to take a whack at, that's kind of where the caption contest come in. So I've had one in the caption contest, I think, and now I don't remember what the winning caption was.
Well, but you had already written a caption for it, and they took it off?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that's what I was wondering. Did the captions that people come up with kind of tend to gravitate toward the original idea?
I think in mine it was in similar channels. I'm sure in some it's kind of all over the place. I think it really depends on how out there the drawing is. I don't personally usually draw things with an eye towards getting it in the caption contest, but I think if you draw like a super wacky scenario that is really open to a lot of interpretation, then those are usually good caption contest candidates.
Have any of the captioners ever become cartoonists? Do you know?
You know, not off the top of my head, although it's ringing a bell that Matt Diffie might have submitted for the caption contest or been sort of attracted to New Yorker cartooning by that, I'm not entirely sure that's true. Yeah, I don't think it's been like a pathway to full-on New Yorker cartooning as far as I know.
Bob Mankoff is the cartoon editor, and he's been doing it for almost 20 years, I think. And mm-hmm. he is a wonderful cartoonist himself. Does he get to decide when he's going to put his own work in?
Well, I mean, he has the weekly cartoon meeting with David Remnick, who's the editor-in-chief. So I think he puts his own work forward for sure. And then, David kind of helps make the ultimate decision there. So he's not, if Bob was just fully in charge of, then I think that would be a pretty easy pass for him. But he's not the only person making the decision. So I think that is a good stopgap in terms of reining in a natural tendency to have your own work in there all the time.
What was it like for you to participate in this documentary, Very Semi-Serious?
It was a really good experience, actually. It was a small crew, and they were all ladies, and they had so much passion for the project. I mean, they sustained that passion for like 8 or 9 years, which is amazing to me. They came in, they had already been filming for, I think, 4 or 5 years when they came and filmed me. And I was pregnant then. My daughter is 3 and a half now. So the fact that they were able to sustain their interest and passion for it is amazing.
Well, it's a wonderful film. It's called Very Semi-Serious, A Partially Thorough Portrait of New Yorker Cartoonists. It opens this Friday at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Emily Flake is a New Yorker cartoonist. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.